because most of modern bird identification and biological species identification is done with phenotypic traits that don't usually fossilize. So if we're actually going to be comparing fossil species to modern species, it'd be nice to have the idea of recognizing species standardized a little bit. So I'm taking bird bones and seeing if I can group them into their biologic species.
Oh, yeah, of course, if the species is extinct, all you have to work with is the fossil record, and that would be just the bones.
Yeah, that's it. It's basically the morphologic species concept. Most modern species are identified using the biologic species concept. There's no way of knowing right now if that one skeleton of Tyrannosaurus rex actually represents one species, or if it represents two or three species that maybe all of the identifying traits that we would use to separate them into biologic species have been obliterated by time.
You said the morphological species concept and the biological species concept. Could you define those for me?
Well, the morphologic species concept is one basically using phenotypic or just physical characteristics of, say, the bird to separate that species from another species.
So like the length of this bone or the width?
Length of the tarsal, the color patterns on the plumage, even the vocalizations. But if you're dealing with a biologic species concept, then you're basically looking at whether those two individuals interbreed and produce a viable offspring, something that usually doesn't fossilize.
Right. What about using genetic markers to identify species?
It's not something that really has been rigorously tested, just because, again, dealing with fossils, most of your genetic markers are going to be obliterated by time as well. It would be very nice to see if the features that we're using to, say, identify a modern bird, like vocalizations and plumage, coloration, and even the ability to interbreed, actually correlate with the features on the skeleton as well, because then we can say, yes, we are actually getting an accurate picture of species diversity back in the fossil record.
Is it true, then, that we don't actually have a real sense of what biodiversity was historically, like in terms of geologic time?
Well, we do know that the apparent biologic diversity in terms of geologic time is much less than the actual biologic diversity in geologic time, just because we're dealing with an incomplete record right off the bat. Depending on the organism that you're dealing with, you might only have 10% of the diversity represented. There's just so much that goes missing through geologic time, just with erosion or just fossils not being preserved at certain time periods. Comparing a full book with all of the chapters in it and then dealing with the abridged version of that book, but going in and randomly ripping out chunks of pages and then trying to read the story, you're going to get a much different story or not as much of a complete understanding of that story than if you had the full unabridged version. So the more work that goes into actually determining fossil diversity, as the better, because more information is always better, especially when you know that you're dealing with an incomplete record.
Well, that sort of leads in well to what I'd hoped to talk to you about, which was fossil conservation efforts in BC.
Ah, yes. Definitely, because it does lead in quite well, because this is also, in terms of fossil vertebrates in British Columbia, we're definitely not dealing with the whole story, because historically, it has not been looked at.
So what do you mean by that? That there hasn't been enough research exploring, like hunting out fossils? Or
it's basically every aspect that you can think of in terms of how to properly manage and research British Columbia's fossil resources. Fossils in British Columbia are basically the best kept secret to the people of British Columbia. Everyone else in the world, I'm quite sure, knows about the wonderful fossil find in British Columbia, the first World Heritage Site, which is the Burgess Shale locality in Yoho National Park. That has one of the best preservation of Cambrian Age soft-bodied organisms in the world. And yet if you ask the average British Columbian off the street, you know, what do you think about the Burgess Shale? They're going to need to have that explained to them a little bit before a memory gets twigged that, oh, yes, this is actually in my province.
So what exactly is fossil conservation? Is that preservation of fossil deposits in place, or is it removing them from the deposits and storing them in museums? Is it just research to try to identify all the different species that are present within the deposits?
All of the above and more. Fossil conservation encompasses not only the academic aspect of it, which is the actual research of the fossil material, but also how to manage the resources when they're discovered by other stakeholders in the province so that it can still be preserved and accessible for public education and for academic research.
So is there a risk that the wealth of fossil resources in BC could be lost?
Definitely. Oh, it is happening already. Until 2005, fossils were considered minerals in terms of how to manage the resource. So prior to 2005, anyone could come across, say, a bone bed of dinosaurs and stake a mineral claim on it, mine it out, and sell it on eBay. That, of course, is the worst-case scenario. But prior to 2005, fossils were treated exactly the same as minerals.
Was that just in B.C., or was that national?
This is just in B.C. Okay. There is no federal jurisdiction over fossil management. It's done on a province-by-province basis.
Thank you so much for talking with us about it today. Did you have anything else that you wanted to add?
Well, for more information, definitely go to the Ministry of Agriculture and Lands website for British Columbia, and stay tuned. We're not done with this yet.
Thanks for that, Rebecca. That's our show for this week. Next week, we'll investigate the plight of the caribou.
Good morning. You are listening to These Things That People Make on CFRU 93.3 FM in Guelph. And I'm starting the show a little bit earlier than I normally do into the theme song because I'm interviewing the second part of Alison Mitchell. And I wanted to cram a lot in. So Alison Mitchell is a fantastic person that I interviewed last week. She is a craft person and an artist and a fat activist and a queer activist and really funny with words. And I originally wanted to interview her because she did this show called A Journey into a Girl's Journey into a Well of Forbidden Knowledge last fall from October to November at the Ontario Art Gallery in Toronto. And I wanted to interview her because the show talks about the Lesbian History Archives and talks about queer sexuality and human sexuality and has some ceramic cats in it covered with gold foil. It's really cool. And I was really curious about her. And so we finally met up a few weeks ago and this is the second half of our interview. I will say that if you're just listening to this half and not the last half, that this is the meat of it. These are the goods. I would encourage you to listen to the other part because it really sort of introduces you to her practice and her history. But if you haven't heard that part, it's okay. Because for the most part, you'll know what we're talking about. We are going to just start off with the interview. If there are pieces while I'm listening that I need to fill you in on, then I'll do that because the interview is divided up into some parts. So you are listening to These Things That People Make. My name is Sarah. Sit back and enjoy this interview with Alison Mitchell that we did in her home. The way that I originally interacted with the pieces, I started reading all the book titles to figure out how many of the books I had or how many of the books I'd heard about. And just like really enjoyed reading the book titles and really like felt like, okay, before I keep playing the interview, I just want to back up. So I want to describe for you a little bit more the show so that you have some more perspective on what Alison is going to and I are going to talk about. So her Alison Mitchell's show at the Art Gallery of Ontario this fall had three walls that were drawings of book titles that she found at the Lesbian History Archives, which are located in Brooklyn, New York. And they're all real book titles of books that deal with issues of lesbianism and queer sexuality. And then in the center of the room, there were two figures that were metallic and very tall, and there was a mirror on the floor, and there was a cat, at least one cat that was gold foiled, and then from the vulvas of the two figures, there was some knitted wool that went up to a brain at the top. It's very aesthetic, lots of silver and purple, and all the books were drawn with pencil. Okay, so that's what I want to tell you, and now we'll go back to the interview.
Aesthetically, the space is set up in such a satisfying way that, like, I just like felt comfortable and comforted and excited to read all these books.
Right.
And
or like if there was a nice, comfortable place to sit.
Yeah.
Always,
yeah.
In every art installation, but.
And then I read the blurb, and the blurb was in this way in particularly serious, and I was like, yeah, but this is also hilarious, right? Like, this is also really funny. Is this not really funny?
Yeah.
And I was like, maybe the AGO doesn't think it's funny. Like, there's just this fun.
Yeah.
This funny...
Well, I think it was just about having to. I think it was people were scared.
People were scared.
It was going to. Like, it had to be worded in a way that people could understand that this fits into a history of.
Yeah.
Blah, 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 blah.
And I liked.
But I would have liked to have something that meant. Nobody has ever said anything about those incredible labias on those sculptures.
Yeah.
Which to me, like, they're giant pudendas and. Enormous clits poking out of their labias. Nobody's said anything about that, which is partly why I want to call it. What time there
well,
is the?
And what I had thought was happening. My theory around the viral title versus the other title was, I was like, the AGO got freaked out and cut out the more provocative title.
No,
and that's not what
they would have let me have it be that name for the show if I wanted it to be. But I really just want to do this kind of like. I felt like what time is the labia closed was like. A community title that was kind of like for us to get to have.
It's a great title.
I don't know, it's a strategy. I don't know if it worked or.
And what was the organ at the top?
It's a giant brain.
Oh.
So they're attached by their crotches to this giant brain.
Okay.
I know it's not a perfect brain, but.
I wasn't sure what it was.
It tries to be a brain.
I thought it might have been a cervix.
Well.
But do you feel like in this piece, do you feel like there's humor in it for you?
Yeah.
Okay. Because I thought so too. Like in the write-up, it was like places for lesbian history. I was like, yes, I agree. But I was like, also this is funny.
Yeah.
also I'm in a giant like Alison Bechdel comic right now. Like also, you know.
Yeah. I know. Maybe I should have said that at the end of the artist statement. Also, this is funny.
But I liked. But I felt like in that way, it's an interesting layer of like inside jokeness where I was.
But it's
like,
also funny to you, but for somebody who's never. I think it's like, okay, the idea that. How do I say this? Okay, Michigan Women's Music Festival. Problematic as it is around issues around gender and trans inclusion. Mm-hmm. You know, I spent some time there in the 90s, and there's always this thing about the only time that cis men came onto the land was when they were coming out to suck the shit out of the Port-a-James or to drop off ice. Like big bags of an ice truck would come on, and like maybe twice a giant food truck would come in, and they get escorted by dykes all the way along who'd be yelling, "Man on the land,
wow.
Put your tops on," so women weren't topless. And it's this idea that that men are wanting to be like, like look at like they'd be masturbating uncontrollably or something.
Yeah.
But they are not. They are terrified.
Yeah.
And as they should be.
Yeah.
And so I think that's part of, for, and I don't mean, I mean, heteronormative on the land. That somebody who has no experience of anything queer culture, any dyke history, walks into a space like that and they're like, what? There's books?
Yeah.
There's books? And there's more than a shelf of books? Like, that was, I think that's really serious. And I kind of like the serious tone for that, for people to see that. And
for even librarians, like even seriously, like public librarians, mm-hmm. Guelph has a really great volunteer-run gay and lesbian queer library. And I almost wept the first time I went in there because I was like, here are all the books I could not find at the library, public libraries anywhere. All these titles I'd heard referenced in academic text, I could not find them.
Yeah. That's awful. Yeah. Right? Which, and people ask me if those were real titles, if I made them up. There's nothing made up, not a single one.
No. You are listening to These Things That People Make. I'm your host, Sarah Mangle. I had the great joy to interview Allison Mitchell a couple weeks ago, and you're listening to an interview with her. We just talked about her show that happened at the AGO in the fall, A Girl's Journey into the Well of Forbidden Knowledge. We're going to go to the next part of the interview really soon. You're listening to Marissa Anderson in the background from her album The Golden Hour. Super badass musician. You should check her out. I do want to just give you a little bit of background on the next part of the interview, because the part that I'm playing, there's a piece that is not airing that is useful. So I told a story to Allison that is not going to be played, and that story was telling a story of the experience of being around sort of liberal environments or so-called queer positive spaces, which aren't in fact queer positive. And by that I mean being able to sort of freely talk about my life, but having being met with silence or being met with people wishing that I didn't say anything because I feel really uncomfortable. So this experience of being a queer person who can be out in lots of different areas of my life, but that doesn't actually mean that I'm being accepted or that I'm being welcomed. So we're talking a little bit about that, the liberal climate of tolerance of queerness.
And that's the kind of thing that I'm really interested in with my work. Mm. From the Sasquatches, lesbian feminist Sasquatches, to a room that's a vagina dentata, to a crazy public-private labia library, mm-hmm. is this social lie about being accepting of quote-unquote diversity, mm-hmm. being accepting of lesbian and gay men, and, you know, in a country where we can get married, but it feels like such a cultural lie around that kind of stuff when I know, like, you know, you can walk down certain streets in the biggest city in Canada, in the context where you're supposed to be accepting and okay, holding hands with somebody who appears to be of the same gender, and you can get bashed. Or even just somebody says something to you. Mm-hmm. And that is, like, it's that lie that I want to, like, pick the scab off of. That it's, like, making this work that's mm-hmm. sweet and familiar with the materials and, like, it's seductive in the materials. Mm-hmm. But it's got this message that you can't ignore.
It's totally unavoidable.
Whether it's about fat bodies or dyke bodies or queer bodies or whatever that people would choose to not see or look away from, make it as big and
as bright,
monstrous as possible. Yeah.
What is it? The word on your website, maximalist? Mm-hmm. That's a great word. This idea where that. In your practice, where part of it is just making it so visible that it is unignorable.
Yeah, and that's the maximalist part, too. It's like maximum politics, maximum emotion, maximum materials, maximum scale. Mm. So it's I feel like also the platform of it has to be the maximum space so that I can build on it so that it can't get pushed over. Hmm. So that's where the maximalist comes from. Rather than, you know, fat women trying to take up less space or... Mm-hmm. That kind of... Rather than cowering, just, like, stomping through a quiet space.
You are listening to an interview with Allison Mitchell. craft person extraordinaire. We're going to go back to that interview now.
I'm wondering about from Riot Girl, from when Pretty and Porky were and Pissed Off were around, from like queer activism at that time to now, like what your impression is, or like where are we now in relation to that time? What's your impression of what's happening with like queers taking up space and with fat queer people taking up space or fat activism?
I don't know. It feels like it's a really exciting time that it's like, I think about the activism that happened around the G20 or the activism that happened around Pride this year was mm-hmm. the best, most exciting time I can remember for a long, long time. Mm. So that all feels really, really great.
What made it the most exciting?
The caring about anything that has to do with Pride. Like, I normally could care less mm-hmm. about anything that has to do with Pride because of its sort of white, normative, male-centric stuff. And that the folks that came together around, you know, there were all these town hall meetings and small direct actions that happened mm-hmm. around trying to... I love the airing of queer dirty laundry in public about people not just sitting back and spooning big gobfuls of bullshit into their mouths and mm. resisting it in really beautiful, colorful ways. So, you know, Take Back the Dyke was like a highlight for mm-hmm. a decade for me of amazing mm-hmm. Community that it's really heartening how big it is, mm. how many people there are, how many people who aren't conformist, who don't want to rally around some kind of fake rainbow unity, you know? Mm-hmm. I love that. It was really, really super exciting.
And you made the Pride as a Pyramid Scheme piece.
Which was so fun because...
So beautiful.
Ended up leading the parade, which Woo! I had no idea that was going to happen. And it was just, you know, it was so sunny and warm yeah. and such a beautiful, beautiful moment. And after all the stuff with the G20 and people, there was such a kind of crackly electric feeling in the air because everybody was so scared because mm-hmm. we were going to take over the streets like the weekend after the G20 mm-hmm. shit had happened. Mm-hmm. People who were there had been arrested and it was really scary. But then as soon as we turned the corner out on the university, it was, you know, you were there. Mm-hmm. It was just like, try and stop us. But also, and then I was looking around at the sidelines and thinking, well, there's nobody here to see how our amazing shit. And I was like, there's nobody here. This is the best Dyke March ever. It was so good. And you know, there's all these people on bikes who were, you know, when you're on bikes, it's really hard to go super slow, but the marshals wanted us to keep it really, really slow. Mm. And bikes kept trying to go out around us and go in front, which is understandable, but it would just be, according to them, unsafe because they didn't, you know, they weren't blocking off the intersections and stuff. So every once in a while, these big butches, would be like, ladies, stay behind the crochet.
I wish you had audio of that.
I know,
and
me
you
too.
You could use that. You could use that.
I'd like to make that my ring on my phone. Yeah, yeah, it was beautiful. It was so great. And they had to be like, get on their bikes behind. The crochet was the authority.
Awesome. That's awesome.
Yeah, that was great.
Whoa.
So that kind of stuff where we are right now yeah. feels really exciting. And also, you know, the stuff that I've never really been a part of that anyway, but divided communities with boy queers and female queers separated. It feels like there's a lot of that, of togetherness, which is exciting. And also, you know, like different geographical spots, like the Hen House and mm-hmm. having, and the Beaver and having these places to go to are really mm-hmm. exciting that aren't, that don't have to do with a gay ghetto or anything like that. Mm-hmm. And lots of really amazing young people doing fantastic stuff. It's great. So you get to have, like, kind of institutions like Inside Out and stuff like that and Pride and critique them and hold them accountable and yell at them, but also just non-institutionalized amazing shit happening too.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I learned a bunch about Skye Gilbert, and then to see people like Skye Gilbert also hold people like highly accountable. Like there's those kinds of moments where I'm like, you are a new hero in my life, and you are following through.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
And actually that person who was the first person who gave me that Super 8 camera and was like, you got to make culture, was my ex-girlfriend Jane Farrow, who had been asked to be the marshal of the Dyke March this year, and she turned it down.
Right on.
And I really feel like that was a big part of getting a lot of folks galvanized behind Take Back the Dyke. Mm-hmm. I think people were sort of, I'm going to wait and see what other people do in response to this. And I really feel like her saying that made a lot of shit happen that was really great.
Know me. I'm not just one of your little toys. You don't own me. Don't say I can't play with other boys.
You are listening to These Things That People Make on CFRU 93.3 FM in Guelph. Background music, Klaus Nomi from his self-titled album, cover of You Don't Own Me. And we are airing an interview today with the amazing Allison Mitchell. I interviewed her in her home in Toronto. And if you want to learn more about Allison Mitchell and her work as we are doing this interview, you can go to a couple of websites. You can check out her website for her work, allisonmitchell.com. And Allison, her name is spelled Allison. And also you can check out the AGO's website, because we were talking earlier in the interview about that exhibit. And if you want to see a picture and, see, the description that they have on their website at the Art Gallery of Ontario, you can go to www.ago.net/Toronto-now-Allison-Mitchell. And, we're going to continue the interview now. This is These Things That People Make with Allison Mitchell.
Whose work inspires you, and what stuff you're working on now?
I'm really inspired by, I love Sherry Boyle. She's one of my favorite artists of all time. I'm very inspired by Ridiculous in New York, and the stuff that they do is really amazing to me. And I love getting little snippets of pockets of scenes in San Francisco and Brooklyn and Regina and Vancouver of cool stuff that queer women are doing. So that's the stuff that's really inspired. Like the Anchor Zine archives and stuff like that. Amazing. Or her Jazz Noise in Vancouver, that kind of stuff. So, right now I'm working on two really big projects that I'm not really hands-on working on right now because I'm teaching a lot until the semester's over, which is really fucking soon. I will be working on my research, which is my actual artwork, but I have to call it that now that I'm a full-time professor. So I'm making dysfunctional food chains with a collection of, I have about 200 found needle points of food and animals and stuff.
Whoa.
So I'm going to make, you know, those food chains that you see in
yeah.
Science textbooks.
Mm-hmm.
So